Your discretion is advised.
Let's try that again, shall we?
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Your discretion is advised.
Okay. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Yeah. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Oh, once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
Think.
Just I like love that. It. That was great. Thank you. All right. Welcome to a Wednesday, everybody.
Somebody's laughing.
Big laughs out in the hall.
A lot of laughter there, apparently. It's a Wednesday. Welcome to America. Aren't you proud? Oh, my goodness. I wasted a couple of hours of my life that I'll never get back this morning watching the Kyle Rittenhouse murder trial. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. It's disturbing because there's a judge in this trial who obviously believes I don't know what he believes, that shouldn't be on the bench because somebody said he doesn't have his finger on the scale. He's full body weight, full on. Just some of the comments I've seen from other people who I know just are calling him out for his blatant covering for the defendant, and let me just say right out front, the prosecutor kind of sucks. He's not very good. He's doing things that he doesn't need to do. Right? He's not a good prosecutor. But this judge is reprehensible, and to prove my point, I'm not even going to point to anything he said today. Let me share with you a thread from my friend Will Bunch. Will Bunch, national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, who tweeted just a little while ago, "I tried to warn you all about Judge Bruce Schroeder. Here's my thread on his troubling history from 2 weeks ago." So he goes back to October 26th, and here's what he wrote. "So you're probably seething about the judge in the Kyle Rittenhouse case saying lawyers can't call the three people he shot, quote, victims, while there's a chance they can be called rioters or looters? Do you wonder what's up with this guy? I did. Buckle up." Again, this is Will Bunch from the Philadelphia Inquirer. "Kenosha County, Wisconsin Judge Bruce Schroeder first started getting noticed early in his 40-plus year career on the bench. In 1987, he made headlines requiring AIDS tests for sex workers. Told he'd be challenged for violating civil liberties, Schroeder said, I hope so. By 2006, Judge Schroeder had such a bad reputation for his outrageous style and stiff sentences that hundreds of defendants had requested a different judge, causing a massive backlog in Kenosha County courts. Schroeder's highest profile case before Rittenhouse was in 2008, when a man was found guilty of murdering his wife with antifreeze, and Schroeder doled out a life sentence. But he botched it. An appeals court tossed the conviction. Schroeder made an evidentiary mistake." And in this thread, Will Bunch links to the news articles about each of these stories that he's citing. I will link to this Will Bunch Twitter thread. Well, I'll retweet it, and I'll post it on the blog where I post today's show at NicoleSandler.com/11-10-21. Though that it's going to be later, and I'll explain that in a bit. Anyway, back to Will Bunch. He writes, "But Schroeder's callous cruelty didn't change. Just this year, the appeals court overturned the judge for, quote, public shaming of a 28-year-old woman convicted of retail theft. He'd ruled the woman couldn't enter a store without telling management about her criminal past." What? "And today's bizarre victims ruling," this, you remember, this was, again, last week or so, when the judge ruled that they could not refer to Kyle Rittenhouse's victims, the people he killed and shot, as victims. So Wilbud Schrodt. And today's bizarre victims ruling was not the first time Schroeder's handling of Rittenhouse killings with the eyes of the nation on the case have drawn fire. In February, protesters were calling for the judge's removal from the case because of his lenient bail terms. Let this sink in, Will Bunch writes. America is a powder keg right now, reeling from an insurrection at the Capitol and amped up violent threats against government officials and even school boards. Armed vigilantes like Rittenhouse on the streets of Kenosha were Exhibit A, and his support from the American right shows a movement willing to celebrate violence. Into the powder keg, the dysfunctional U.S. justice system has tossed a massive stink bomb, one of the worst judges in the nation. I would plead with the legal system in Wisconsin to use whatever means are available to remove Judge Schroeder and name an impartial, respected jurist. Failure in this case could have serious consequences, not just for Kenosha, but for the nation. Now, let me tell you what happened earlier today. Before I even read Will Bunch's Twitter thread, you know, I was watching this travesty of justice, and I put out a simple tweet. And I said something along the lines of, can we get rid of this guy and get an impartial judge, please? Well, somebody obviously took my tweet and posted it to some MAGA place because, oh my God, did they pile on. Now I understand what the term being ratioed is, because they came at me on Twitter. You know, the tweet had, I don't know, had a few dozen likes and retweets. And then the counter on the responses was just spinning like a, you know, like a top. And it was all these MAGA trolls, most of them bots, I'm sure, but trolls nonetheless, with the vilest, ugliest things that they're saying to me. And I just blocked them and blocked them and blocked them. And finally, I made my tweets private. So it'll just be for a few days until the troll activity calms down. But this is this is what we're up against. So basically, these people are defending this kid, saying he didn't do anything wrong. Again, I blocked them all, and so I can't even read to you some of the responses. Not that you'd want to hear them, because they really are reprehensible. I mean, the dregs of society. These people, you know, they're commenting on my looks. By the way, I'm fat and ugly. Okay? They don't like my hair. Nothing about substance, right? Except I'm a Karen. I mean, this is the kind of shit they're throwing at me. So, you know, again, I'm ignoring them. But just so you know, if you don't follow me on Twitter and you're going to see my tweets today, you can't. But here's the thing. We are so fucked. And look, if the Will Bunch article wasn't enough for you, there's a big story in the Washington Post today. Let me share a little bit of that with you. Washington Post by Scott Wilson. Regardless of how he is viewed, Judge Bruce E. Schroeder is indisputably a man with fixed rules for how trials in his Kenosha County courtroom will be run. Some are basic, some unorthodox, and all reflect the experience of a jurist who believes trials can be too easily manipulated, particularly by the prosecution. So lawyers are saying, for a jury trial, if you can get him, you're happy as a defense attorney. Let me share with you. I'm going to scroll down because this is a long article. I will post a link to this article as well on the blog. But here's the part. Okay, so just so you know, the reason that that Kyle Rittenberg went to Kenosha in the first place is because there were protests. They were peaceful protests until people like Kyle Rittenhouse showed up with an AR-15. They were protesting the fact that a young black man, Jordan Blake, I believe was his name, was shot multiple times by police. Thankfully, he wasn't killed. He's now paralyzed. But so people were rightfully, peacefully protesting that. Kyle Rittenhouse decided he needed to cross state lines and bring an AR-15 with him for self-defense. It wouldn't be self-defense if he didn't go in the first place. So let me read to you just an excerpt from this Washington Post article. Justin Blake, that's Jordan's, I think, cousin or brother, he's related to the man that the protests were about, right? Because he was shot by the police. Justin Blake singled out one of Schroeder's rulings that has generated anger and confusion from many quarters, even though it long has been one of the judge's most steadfast rules. As the trial began last week, Schroeder forbade the prosecution from calling the three men Rittenhouse shot victims, which the judge has long called a loaded term. He prefers decedents or complaining witnesses. What? The judge prohibited the prosecution from entering evidence allegedly showing links between Rittenhouse and the Proud Boys, a white nationalist group. He also rejected the prosecution's request to be allowed to tell the jury about a June 2020 incident when Rittenhouse allegedly attacked a woman who at the time was in a fight with his sister. But Schroeder then also prohibited the defense from describing the men as looters or rioters unless the attorneys can prove they were involved in those acts. Okay, the thing is, he is not an impartial judge. He is so obviously got his, you know, he already knows where he is. And the way he let loose on this prosecutor, who I agree, is not doing a great job. But the way he spoke to him, it's a good thing I'm not a lawyer. If I was in the courtroom and a judge talked to me like that, I'd be in jail for contempt because I'd tell him to go fuck himself. But the whole thing is just, so Randy's show, Diane Russell said we watched 2 hours at Randy's show. Well, I'm not gonna run the whole thing for you. But one part I did catch, I went back to it. I guess I'm a glutton for punishment or something. At one point, the prosecution wanted to put some images up on the screen. And so he wanted to enlarge them. And you know how when you have a picture on the screen, like on an iPad, and you put your fingers on and you stretch it and that enlarges it. Well, the judge couldn't grok the idea that you just enlarge it like that. And he's like, you need to bring in an expert to show me that you're not manipulating the pixels. And it is, I would say it's a joke, but joke implies that there's something funny. There's nothing funny here. This is dangerous. This is scary. In this case, you know, this is about being able to shoot somebody. There was one tweet. Let me see if I can't find this one. Again, my Twitter stream has been kind of, throttled today. So, but God, where was this one? There was one great one, and I don't even remember who said it. This is what I get for just putting them all in one file and thinking I'll be able to find it when the time comes. Because there's so many things going on today that are just reprehensible. Okay. Well, Josh Barrow, I'll go here. Josh Barrow, a Republican, actually, who wrote, it was morally reprehensible for Rittenhouse to voluntarily put himself in a position where he was likely to feel compelled to use deadly force against another person. I'm not going to read the second part of him because that part is a moot point. The bottom line is this is just so reprehensible. Here's the tweet I was looking for. Wajahat Ali writes, so people can carry assault rifles and shoot aggressive and violent protesters who are harassing teachers and doctors and parents at school board and city council hearings? Let us know, Kyle Rittenhouse defenders. I'm assuming the answer is yes. Terrifying if so. The whole thing is terrifying. What they are trying to make allowances for this then 17-year-old kid to be a vigilante, to go out and shoot people, claiming self-defense when he put himself in that position in the first place? It's just, you know, I talk about opposite world all the time. This is that. This is opposite world. It's just astounding. Now, there was one moment of high drama, high drama, and this I will show you. So Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, testified in his own defense. Boy, was he rehearsed. I mean, this was a, you know, it was a picture perfect playback of he was calm, he was collected, he answered the questions. He almost and I say almost, sounded, like he knew what he was talking about. He almost sounded like he was actually saying these things of his own accord. But then, then the acting kicked in. Oh, yeah. So here's just a clip of Kyle Rittenhouse testifying in his own defense. And he was asked to talk about what happened when he decided to shoot these people, two of whom he killed, the third one he just injured horrifically. And this happened.
Died. And I was cornered from in front of me with Mr. Zeminski. And there were...
Oh, no.
There were... people right there.
Oh, no. Usually when someone cries, there are tears. There are tears. The nose starts running. The face gets all red. Oh, please. Oh, fuck you. Someone give that man a Razzie. Really? And then the judge gives him time to compose himself. Oh, please. Oh, please. So, actually, a very unlikely person weighed in. And I think we should hear what the former president had to say. Because, Donald Trump has something to say about everything. And I guess he had something to say about Kyle Rittenhouse breaking down. Because that is the new face of MAGA, right? What do you think, Donald?
So I'm watching this trial of this beautiful young man, Kyle Rittenhouse.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we used to have Brad's, then we had Todd's, and now we have Kyle's. Sort of like the next beautiful phase of strong white young men.
Oh, my God.
Right, Mike Pence? You said you love strong white young men. Mike Pence, our great vice president. Also, a big Paul Rudd fan, very strongly supports Paul Rudd as...
Sexiest
so,
man
you
alive.
You said to me, though, you said, sir, after you... Paul Rudd. So thank you, Mike. Thank you. But I'm watching this trial of this poor, defenseless young man, Kyle Slaughterhouse. And I see him, and he's a big, strong young man.
He's a big, strong
and
young man.
I could tell he was thinking of me because he got tears in his eyes. And he was on that stand, and he was... crying so beautifully because all they did was beautiful Second Amendment.
Oy.
Okay, it's one of our sacred, I would say our most sacred right. And they want to take that from him. They want to put him in jail for just loving his Second Amendment.
Oh, God.
Because he shot some people like dogs. Okay, but not like in a Michael Vick sort of way, you know, in a sort of way that you should get the... capital punishment, okay? And you shoot dogs like dogs. No forgiveness, especially if you're an African-American trying to steal a precious quarterback position, which belongs to great free thinker people like Aaron Richards, okay, who's one of our great people. So
one of our great people.
Greatly.
Yeah.
But Kyle was on that stand. Sitting. That's how stupid is that? They call it on the witness stand, and then you sit. That's why I don't trust our court system. It's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. Get on the witness stand and then have a seat.
There you go.
But Kyle, we cry. I don't cry. Not. I'm too strong for that. But metaphorically, we cry, and we'll see what happens.
Donald Trump, everybody, reacting to poor old Kyle Rittenhouse cry. Well. Pretend crying on the stand. For those who don't know, that is the brilliant and talented J.L. Coven. He is our resident Donald Trump. He comes out, he puts up videos on YouTube just immediately. So that happened, and that was up moments later. So Murashani, when you say, I can't believe this, it's J.L. Coven. It's J.L. Coven. Yes, you're welcome. Because right about now, we could all use a bit of laughter, right? Right. All right. I do have other stuff to share with you. We have a guest coming up. I'm surprised I don't see him yet. I saw him in the chat room a moment ago. Harvey JK, where are you? Come on in. Oh, and where's Harvey? There he is. So I need a moment. I do need a moment to get the shot all set up. But we can do that. We can do that fairly quickly. And so while we do that, I guess we can do this. This.
Well, where is he?
Where is who?
Where is Harvey?
Oh, you mean Harvey J.K.
Yeah, Harvey.
Well, he's coming up right now on the Nicole Sandler Show.
Hello, Harvey J.K. Harvey, can you hear me? Oh, your mic is not on. For some reason, I see your camera icon, but I don't see your microphone icon. Ah, there it is. Now you can talk.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Like Excellent. Magic. Like magic.
Excellent.
So,
Excellent.
Harvey
Only
J.K.
A minute late.
Harvey J.K., you are the professor emeritus of democracy and justice studies, if I recall correctly, at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And so my initial question goes to the topic that you taught, that you professed for years, justice, liberty and justice for all. That's what we have here in America, isn't it?
Sorry, my silence is, you know what? I'm wondering if I should get some earplugs. I'm hearing an echo.
You're hearing an echo.
Let's do this.
Echo.
Can you still hear?
I can hear it. What? No, now I can't hear you. Talk.
Okay, hold on.
Live radio, everybody. We should have tested this earlier.
I apologize.
That's all right.
Can you hear me now?
I hear you. You hear me?
I'm still echoing.
It's still echoing, huh? I don't know why it's echoing.
I wonder if I should go get earphones.
You know what? I'm going to try one other thing, too. It shouldn't be an issue, but I can try one other thing. While we try to figure out the technical issues, Harvey J.K., let me ask, did you watch any of this travesty today? I mean, I would think you would have, because it's a Kenosha, Wisconsin courtroom. You live in Wisconsin.
No, I don't watch it.
You were smart, because
Yeah,
it's just made me crazy. So
I catch the highlights through CNN.
Right.
Kind of
now it's worse. Now I have the echo coming back to me.
You know what? Give me 2 minutes. I'm going to run upstairs and get it.
Okay.
Get a set of earphones.
You go do that.
See if it makes a difference. Okay.
Sure. Why not? And I'm actually looking on my, I'm pulling you down, looking on my things to see if there's a control here that I can mess with. This mixer that I have is so cool, but it has just a lot of moving parts, and some of them I can't quite figure out, especially not on the fly like this. So we'll wait till Harvey gets back. He's going to get headphones, so hopefully he can hear us without the echo. So Harvey is the author of numerous books about FDR and the Four Freedoms, about Thomas Paine. He's a historian and a professor. And the other day, Harvey tweeted out a story from The Nation magazine, written by John Nichols, about the Biden kind of needing to govern like FDR. And oh my God, Harvey, that tweet got so much action. People were either applauding it and agreeing with it or arguing with you as if you had written the article that John Nichols wrote. But why don't you tell us what the gist of that was about?
Well, gist is this. Like, here we, okay, hold on one second. So I'm not echoing now.
No, you sound great. Everything sounds
so
good.
Okay, I'll leave these, I'll leave these earrings in, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So okay. The basis of the article is that, you know, people forget, but let's start over the fact it's been 9 months, are we even 10 months possibly, of the Biden administration. You're looking askance. Did I?
No. I'm just checking. I'm checking my equipment.
So it's been 10 months. And let's be clear about it. I want to go back and talk about this kind of thing, about how the Biden administration made initial proposals, sort of entering into the presidency, that not only did they almost immediately fail to fulfill, Let's be clear about that. The first 100 days saw a significant American rescue plan, undeniably.
Right. That was quick. It was right there. It was like, okay, we're off to a good start.
Absolutely. And then it was like flatline. Is that what they call it?
You know, and then nothing, right?
And I kept saying to myself, the $15 minimum wage thing scared me.
Yeah, yeah.
Even before that, I bet I've mentioned this to you maybe in the last show. The Biden administration did something that the Biden team did something that the Obama team had done. That is, before the actual moment of taking the oath of office, sometime in the weeks before, they had their man, Barack in one case, Joe in the other, meet with a group of historians.
Okay.
And when he did so back when Obama did it in 2008-09, that winter before he took office, the crew of historians immediately led me to say, we're in trouble. Because let's assume for a moment that if the president's making a point, or the president-elect is making a point of meeting with historians and announcing it, basically it was announced, I mean, to the extent that it showed up in stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times, you would think that this is an indication that whatever these historians have to say to this man is really important. And he's seriously interested in what they might have to say as to how he might have not just a successful presidency, but I know in both cases they had in mind what makes a great president.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that the crew in the first instance was basically made up of capital P presidential historians. And I can tell you that anyone who's a critical historian, you know, sort of academic or, you know, intellectually informed historian generally laughs at presidential historians because they treat the presidency in isolation from the larger political order. And what I mean by that is, yes, it's the president in relation to Congress or the Supreme Court, okay, to whatever. Okay. And they love telling stories, presidential historians. And they love showing up on CNN and MSNBC, or if they're right wingers, likely Fox.
Right.
Okay. But what they're doing is they're looking at what's called indoor politics. Indoor politics.
As opposed to outdoor politics, right?
As opposed to outdoor politics.
Got it.
And there are two kinds of outdoor politics, mm-hmm. one of which there are certain figures in history who have been very good at. And those are the folks who have a really good communications team or can really give a damn good speech. And as a consequence, leaves people thinking or inspired, whatever it might be. The first cut basically is, in Obama's case, turned out to be absolutely the case of indoor politics. The whole Medicare, not Medicare, I wish it were Medicare, the whole Obamacare,
right,
the Affordable Care Act, they took an incredible amount of time negotiating with, I believe, two senators from Maine.
Oh, yes.
Remember Snow and Susan, what's her name?
Collins. Olympia Snow and Susan Collins. Olympia
right.
Snow got the message and left, but we're still stuck with Susan Collins.
Yeah. And right. along the way, they dropped the public option,
which,
by the way, it should have been right from the beginning.
Of course.
They had 60 votes. They had the Senate.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep.
So I know that the advice these guys gave him was all indoor politics advice.
Right.
Nothing to do with the outdoor politics.
No.
And by the way, Obama was renowned, even if nobody quotes him today, because his words were terribly insignificant, ultimately.
Yeah.
The fact is that he was very good at giving a speech.
Oh, very good at giving a speech.
Right.
That's
right.
Why he rose in prominence. Right.
Right. Unfortunately, after that 2004 speech, which may be the only thing he'll ever be quoted for eventually.
Right.
The words he said thereafter were pretty insignificant, frankly. I mean, I'm being nice.
Yep. I know.
Being nice.
I know.
Okay.
I'm not arguing with you.
So here's Biden. Now, Biden, whoever, I don't know who chose the historians to gather, but I have a feeling it was the historian whose words he himself was constantly quoting. That John Meacham or Meacham,
John
depending
Meacham.
How you want
John
to pronounce
Meacham,
it.
John Meacham, yep.
The Soul of America, amongst a host of other books. But I want to make something
clear. John Meacham, who, by the way, let me just say, and I have nothing for or against John Meacham. He's just there in my book. But he puts himself out there as a presidential historian and goes on TV to be a pundit, but never disclosed the fact that he wrote speeches for Joe Biden, like his inaugural speech, right?
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, let me add something. And let me remind people, look, I don't expect anyone to remember this but me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe me.
But back in 2008, mm-hmm. after Obama won the presidency,
yeah.
I believe Meacham. That point he was the editor of either Time or Newsweek, something like that. He was doing something along those lines. He was writing for them in a very editorial-like way.
Really? Okay.
And I can quote the speech. I can quote exactly what he wrote if you'd like, but we'll do that next time.
Okay.
What he said, really, was he sent is like an open letter to Obama that Obama should appreciate that this is a center-right nation.
Right. Yep.
Oh, you do remember. Okay, good.
I do remember that. Yep.
Now, by the way, that's bullshit.
Yep.
Absolute bullshit. Okay. When it came to policies, we know what Americans want. They've said it over and over again. Give us Medicare.
He was editor-in-chief at Newsweek, by the way.
Right. There you go. Exactly. Okay. So now he not only is he giving an open letter to Obama, he's now literally he's like whispering in Biden's ear. He's got Biden's ear. I mean, Biden basically was preaching, and I use the word preaching because that's pretty much what it was.
Yeah.
That this is presidency was going to restore the soul. That it was
the soul of America.
The
right?
soul of America. Okay. But historians he brought together were all probably better historians than the ones that Obama got to meet with.
Uh-huh.
Except that they were no better at giving Biden the kind of advice he needed, because in addition to the soul of America, Biden continually dropped the reference. Well, not dropped as in let go of, but literally made it clear through Ron Klain and others mm-hmm. that he was going to pursue an FDR style presidency.
Right.
Now, FDR style presidency, if you ask some historians, the liberals, and I say liberals nicely.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't look they at will that tell as a bad word either.
That you've got to go. They'll tell you, yes, you must go big. Look at the New Deal. Look at the vast array of programs.
Right.
Okay. The problem is that, and by the way, and that is what made FDR initially so, so popular. Okay? Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. I mean, and by the way, elected in 1932, in 1934, the Democrats walloped the Republicans in the midterms. Walloped.
Okay.
They already had control of Congress. They practically drove the Republicans out of Congress altogether. That's how effective they were.
Okay.
Okay. Why? Because Americans wanted more New Deal. Even if it hadn't yet radically transformed America, the point was they wanted more of it. Go FDR, go, you might say. I can tell you that I doubt if a single one of the presidents that Meacham brought in to talk to Biden would have told him, not just, they would have told him about going big. I don't think they would have hesitated in that.
Right.
I mean, you didn't need a historian to tell you that, I would say. But what they failed to indicate is that Roosevelt didn't just go big. From the very beginning, in the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, in the first 100 days,
mm-hmm.
in the Agricultural Adjustment Act, however ultimately inadequate those bills, laws were, they did something. They empowered working people and farmers. Okay.
Okay.
They actually instated in the National Industrial Recovery Act that workers had the right to organize and bargain collectively.
What a concept. Yes.
What a concept, right?
Right.
And
yep.
farmers and the Agricultural Adjustment Act, there were lots of things that people didn't like about it. But one of the things is they created boards literally to help regulate agricultural production on which farmers sat.
Okay.
And by the way, as a footnote to that, people don't realize because they always say, well, FDR didn't do anything to help African Americans vote back in the 30s. But the fact is that if you were a Black landowning farmer and they existed,
mm-hmm.
you had a chance to vote on these kinds of questions regarding economic agricultural activity.
Okay.
And there were those who, and as a consequence, he won the hearts of the landowning, small farming African-Americans
okay.
in the South.
Right.
Okay. So here's the thing. Again, as I say, they were terribly inadequate, these bills. Companies found their way around it. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that went wrong. But then he turned around in 1935, having won so handily in 1935, not he himself, but the Democrats. And he then signed into law the Social Security Act and the National Labor Relations Act, which was the most powerful tool that labor had ever been granted.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it did is it created the National Labor Relations Board. And basically what it said was, between the lines is government will stand behind workers' efforts to organize. They're not going to stand back to mediate, stand back to balance the story. They were going to be a countervailing power behind labor to make sure that capital, the business folk, had to recognize unions. Now, but even when that occurred, FDR said regarding that and other bills, he would say, new laws in themselves do not bring the millennium, meaning you're still going to have to fight. And he was so right, because companies, these big corporations, their lawyers told them, you know, it's not constitutional until the Supreme Court decides it is. You don't have to bow to that law until the Supreme Court decides it's constitutional. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, in the mid-1930s, and by the way, this was revealed in a series of hearings that took place across the country, led by Wisconsin progressive, but not a Democrat, but a progressive, Robert La Follette Jr.
Ah, fighting Bob La Follette. Yes.
Okay. So, so this is the son, not the father.
Okay.
This is the son who was no less radical.
Okay. Oh, gotcha.
And what he revealed in the course of this, the traveling, bringing this, these hearings across the country, was that the companies had been stockpiling weapons, literally mini armies.
Companies,
you know, like armored cars, machine guns, the whole, because they were prepared to go to war if labor demanded a recognition of their rights.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, okay. Now, but let me come back to this question you kind of posed. Okay. Why, you know, why should people pay attention to FDR regarding what Biden should do?
Right.
Well, first of all, FDR, in the first New Deal of 1933, mobilized American unemployed people in vast numbers, not all of them, but in vast numbers,
right,
to participate in public works projects.
Hello. That's what pulled us out of the Depression, isn't it?
Yes. Well, absolutely. And by the way, there were two agencies. One was, this could be confusing. One was the PWA that he set up in 1933, which that took a while to get going because that was going to operate through contracts going out to engineering firms to take responsibility for the biggest of the project.
Okay. You know,
we're going to build a dam or a bridge, that kind of thing. But at the same time, he created, there were a number of operations, initiatives. One was the CWA, the Civil Works Administration.
Right.
And they immediately put people to work handling road repair, parks, schools, even beginning to lay out tracks for, you know, like rural airports, things like that.
Okay.
More importantly, once they won in 1934, the Congress, once they were secured in their hold on power, mm-hmm, they passed something that enabled them to create the WPA. This is the famous
works.
And this is where they brought literally millions of Americans into working on significant infrastructure projects.
Infrastructure. Okay? Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Road building.
Hello.
Building schools, libraries, post offices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Plus, in the very first 100 days, they created the Civilian Conservation Corps, which ultimately would have, like, I don't know, like 2 million in the course of the 30s young American boys and men going to work, planting trees to fight soil erosion and the Dust Bowl in the Midwest. And I mean, it's a vast enterprise. I think they planted 3 billion trees.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
So, and then they created the Rural Electrification Agency, which was the first time in which farmers, especially in the South, were going to get electricity lines into their farmsteads. The private utilities would not do it because they didn't think it would be profitable.
Oh,
they
wow.
said, screw the farmers.
Right, sure.
We can't make enough money on them.
Well, the correlation today is internet. That a lot of these rural communities don't have broadband because the cable companies don't want to run it because it's not profitable enough for them.
But what FDR and his you know, New Dealers did is they created electric co-ops.
Mm.
And I believe within a half a dozen years, it might have been as much as 400,000 farms. You could now go into a barn and into a house or into the barn, turn on a light. And by the way, you might say, well, who'd want to go in the barn at night, right? Farmers have to go in the barn at night, believe me.
Right, of course.
Moreover, if you went into the barn where there was no electricity, it meant you went in with a lantern.
Right, which is a fire hazard.
And needless to say, farm blazes were common.
Of course.
Okay? So this was liberating.
Right.
So people, okay, so this is, first of all, the mobilization of American labor. How's that for a start?
Okay.
But let's go back. They empowered workers to organize. They empowered farmers to participate in making big decisions about agricultural production. Mm-hmm. So in other words, they not only engaged Americans in building back better. To coin a phrase. They actually empowered workers with what was they called in the 1930s industrial democracy.
Okay.
And the closest thing today would be this bill that's sitting outside, you know, sitting in Congress, going nowhere, the PRO Act, which basically would be the means by which workers would be guaranteed, okay, that they can organize and bargain collectively.
Right.
By way of, you know, by basically, when so many workers want a union, the union exists. You don't then have to hold elections. When workers say they want a union, you listen to them, they have a union. And the company must then bargain in good faith. I mean, it's that simple as that. Now let's go back again to the past year. Number one, after the American Rescue Plan, things literally disappeared.
Right.
We didn't hear. And first of all, I still have no idea if Kamala Harris really is vice president.
She technically is.
I don't know what she's doing. Okay.
I don't know.
I just don't know. But half the time, I don't know what Joe Biden's doing, actually.
Right. Okay.
So the thing. Okay. That's first. We didn't get the $15 minimum wage.
No.
Okay.
Yep.
Then it's they present the plans, Build Back Better. You know, they're releasing ideas and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
Manchin and Sinema made it clear, along with a number of other people whose names shall go, you know, we will not bother to mention their names. Chris Coons.
No, I know, because there's a bunch of them. There's two from New Hampshire. The two from Delaware. But besides the point. But there was.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So here's the thing. So what did Biden begin to do? Well, poor Bernie basically saw these plans getting whittled from $6 trillion down to $3.5 trillion
to down to $1.5 trillion.
And basically Bernie probably figured, okay, now we go to war to make sure these things happen. Look, we got the two seats from Georgia. What else can you expect? I've given you these great plans.
Let's do it. You need to enact them so then we can reap the benefits.
So what did Biden do? He fell into what we call indoor politics mode.
Negotiating themselves.
I'm going to meet with them. Okay. Schumer, I'm going to meet with them. Pelosi, at least Pelosi surprised everyone for, you know, she said, we're going to do it in tandem.
Well,
we're
temporarily, until she caved.
Until she
demanded her caucus go back on the deal that they had been touting from day one.
Right. And so what we saw is that after the American Rescue Plan, what Biden should have done is this. I got two plans. Here's the two things he should have done. Okay. The first thing, knowing that Manchin and Sinema were going to give him trouble. Well, he doesn't have far to go to get to Delaware to basically tell Chris Coons to get in line.
Coons will do whatever he tells him to do. Chris Coons has that seat because Joe Biden gave it to him.
Right, which, by the way, is also telling, because when he voted again, when the senators from Delaware and the senators from New Hampshire voted against the $15 minimum wage, basically slapped Bernie in the face, okay, Biden could have built back better himself.
Yes, he could
That's
have.
All I can
yes,
tell
he
you.
Could okay. have. Yes, he
okay,
could have.
Okay, now, okay. So so the first thing is that how does he respond? Well, FDR in 1938, when he didn't have as much control over Congress as he previously had, because although the Democrats were strong in Congress, the Democrats from the South, the white supremacists, really were afraid that FDR was going to push some kind of civil rights agenda. Mm-hmm. So he wanted a third New Deal, basically. Okay. Mm-hmm. So ultimately he would fail in this initiative, although World War II is kind of a third New Deal, which we can talk about another time. But FDR said, to hell with this. I'm going to try to purge the Democratic Party in the midterms. He basically declared war on 8 members of Congress.
Okay. Okay.
He only in the end was able to unseat one, but what he did was significant. And even though he lost in his pursuit, the American folks in the South loved him for it. He went down to Georgia, a truly reactionary state, mm-hmm. headed by one of the most reactionary of Southern gubernatorial regimes. I think it was called the Talmadge regime.
Okay.
And he gave a speech at which I believe Talmadge was present. And he talked about how the South was a drag on the recovery because the political and social and economic order in the South was like feudalism.
Uh-huh.
And then he said, and he was really direct, he says, and if you believe in feudalism, you believe in fascism.
Okay.
Now, believe me, you couldn't get much more. He went south. Keep in mind, this is in the heart of the most reactionary area in the United States at the time. White supremacist ruled. And he's basically saying, we got to get rid of these people. That's right. what he's saying.
Okay. I'm glad he did. But you know what? Everything is different now.
Yes, but why didn't Biden? I'm sorry.
Why didn't
he go there? Your mic.
That's okay.
But I'm trying to distract you from a very painful day. Okay.
It's going to get better. I'm going to a concert tonight. So.
Oh, great. That's really. Oh, who are you going to see?
I'm seeing Jackson Browne and James Taylor.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Last time we talked. Oh my God.
Go, it's tonight.
Great.
So the minute the show ends, I'm not going to do that after show. What's news? If you want to hear what's news, you can go to the website and get it or to get the podcast, because right at 6 o'clock, we got a bolt. So they go on at 7:30.
Okay, so let me go on here. Okay. So what should Biden have learned? By the way, those historians he met with last, say, December, early January, they should have told him these stories. And that way Biden would have thought, wait. And Bernie and Biden might have put their heads together and said, hey, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Let's call up a number of the members of the squad and let's invite them. Let's go down to West Virginia. Let's tell Manchin that he can join us.
Right.
Because we're going to promote Build Back Better at $3.5 trillion. And we know the people of West Virginia. I think the governor, who's a Republican, wanted the $3.5 trillion too, because he wanted money for his state.
Right. And actually, they should have just brought Bernie, because Bernie did better in West Virginia.
No, exactly.
Right.
Bernie is a champion in West Virginia.
Absolutely.
Biden's the president.
But
AOC
Bernie
or whoever
got
else
more
you
votes.
Want to bring.
Bernie Younger? Did better yes. in the primaries oh, than
absolutely.
Biden by a long shot.
Absolutely. And but you bring along some of the younger folks.
Sure.
Right.
Please.
To bring the kids
yes.
out to
yes.
attend. And you tell Manchin, you don't want to be left out of this.
Right.
And you're going to endorse this
yes.
right there, yeah. right then and there. Okay. And if Manchin said no, then you go down to West Virginia and you say, you know what? If you believe in feudalism, you believe in fascism. Is there anybody in this state who you think is the real obstruction? I mean, you call him out. Well, he didn't do that, right? So that's that. Now,
right.
let's suppose he did all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next step is a national tour.
Uh-huh. Yep.
With Bernie
yep.
and with look, the majority of the Senate will back Build Back Better.
Of course they will. No, it's the it's the small group of holdouts led by Manchinima.
Right. And then you have Bernie call up all the folks in the pop and rock and, you know, and hip hop rap area.
Yes.
I mean, Bernie's got a huge
everywhere
popular support.
Right? Yep.
And have them, depending on where you are, turn out with them. You
of
make
course.
It into like during World War II, the war bond shows where people turned out, you know, and it was like a big extravaganza. And you make sure that Americans realize that if these folks who, you know, name Manchin, Sinema, Coons, whoever else, if they oppose this, they oppose your aspirations.
Right. Well, of course.
Because you know what? Even if you don't get them to vote the way you need them to vote, the American people will know you're on their side and they'll have turned out to show that if others don't follow suit, we'll come for you too.
Right. But Harvey, so the disconnect here has been that Joe Biden has been MIA along with Kamala Harris. They haven't been touting this. They're just like
right.
sitting back and, oh, we'll let them fight it out. Well, that's not okay. Look what it did look what it's done to his polling numbers. Look what it did to Election Day last week. You know, inaction has consequences.
Yeah. I mean, progressives at the local level in many places won. Because they were speaking to what American working people want
right. and right.
need.
And the reason that the Democrats are perceived in so much trouble right now, and it seems that it's not just a perception in this
right.
case is
it's
reality,
not.
is because they've been dragging their feet. Nothing's been done on major prosecutions for the people who planned January 6th. We had a president trying to enact a coup to stay in control. And where's the sense of urgency? You know, Obama's big sense was the fierce urgency of now. Well, now there's a fierce urgency, but we're the only ones feeling
it. Right. It's a, we'll say the fiercer urgency of now. And next year it'll be the fiercest urgency of now. No, and I say that, and when I come on the show and we always seem to have a good time, it's all tragicomic.
It really is.
I mean, it's funny, but we know you and I are crying inside. Oh my God. This is crazy.
This is horrible. Crying. I'll tell you something. I get so discouraged covering this. And I was thinking that once we got Trump out of office, I didn't think immediately things would turn around. And listeners of this program will remember, I had my worries about Joe Biden. First of all, I didn't think he could win, so I was wrong on that one. I think Jackson, my dog, could have won against Donald Trump because most of the people turned out to vote against Donald Trump, not for Joe Biden. We would have voted for whoever was on the ballot to replace the orange one.
Well, I'm sure young people were voting for some kind of absolution from the tens of thousands of dollars that they owed for their college education.
Well, and that, you know, that's just one of many things that he's not delivering on. And so, you know, the inaction, the fact that that he got the first relief thing and then nothing,
And, and the college debt question is a signature away. You know, he said he was having the lawyers check into the constitutionality. No. You sign it and then let somebody
challenge it. And then let them fight it out. Exactly.
Let them fight it out with 25-year-olds who'll be outraged, pissed off, and ready to march if you take if you take back the,
I know. I know. There's so much that to be disappointed in. So now, you know, I revert to my old stance of I'm going to criticize whoever is in charge because I want them to do better, not because I want to excoriate them and say, you suck. Believe me, I wish I could. You know how I was at the beginning of this administration.
Sure.
I stopped you from criticizing. I'm like, give them a chance. Let's give them a
chance.
You did. I know
Shame
I
on
did.
You for criticizing.
Hey, but I tried to give him a chance. And at the beginning, it was good. I'm like, I'm pleasantly surprised. Until here we are.
Yeah, I look, I'll go back to it. I tell you, I saw it happen with Obama and I feared it was going to happen with Biden. I know it's trivial. I know most people, you know, think I always make a mountain out of a molehill. If you're going to bother to get advice from historians, get the advice that tells you how to engage and encourage your fellow citizens, not just give you good stories over a dinner party.
Right. And then we have to add on the other part of it that fully is, you know, indicative of an opposite world. You listen to the media, the fucking pundits, and it's like, oh, it's the progressives who did this. They held the whole thing hostage. No, what happened is they stood their ground and the goddamn conservadems, who they insist on calling moderates, they're not moderate, tanked the deal that they had in order to ensure leverage so both sides would get what they wanted. And instead, they gave away all their leverage. And now, you know, I'm hearing the people on the outside back and forth between the Build Back Better is dead to, oh, but it's not dead yet. But yeah, it's probably dead because they gave away their leverage.
Yeah. And, you know, so now to go back to John Nichols' article where we began this,
right?
What John was trying to say to people is that Biden has got to take, he's got to take direction from FDR, because FDR, first New Deal, they won big in 34.
Right.
Second New Deal, he won the largest landslide imaginable for a president up until that time. In 1938, he pursued the fight. And by the way, they secured the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was the first time, and it stands to this day, that even the court bowed to the fact that, yes, a national minimum wage was constitutional, period. Okay.
Right.
And then he won 1940, again, the presidency. And then in 1944, I'm sure you've heard me tell you this many times, in January 44, he called for an economic bill of rights.
Yes.
And both the AFL and the CAO, which were separate labor federations at the time, and a whole host of black organizations and everyone else, literally went overboard to promote the idea of an economic bill of rights. Now, the Republicans and Southern Democrats stood in the way. Okay. But he happened to turn that into a victory in 1945 when he won his fourth term as president.
Wow.
So the point, and he unfortunately tragically passed away in later in the spring of that year. But what John Nichols was trying to do, and he and I do this, sometimes we do this as have us on together.
You'll I would love to.
Oh, we're like a tag team. Okay.
Let's do it. Yeah.
I mean, John and I have known each other for 25 years.
Yep.
He often
You're both Wisconsinites. And so you know each other. We'll do that. I'll get in touch with John and we'll set that up. So wrap this up because I have one more thing I need to ask you about.
So I'm wrapping it up and saying that if Biden doesn't get his ass in gear, he ain't going to be ever an FDR. Go ahead.
Okay. You're in Wisconsin.
Yes.
I know you are a part owner of the Green Bay Packers because I was a fan of the Packers because they're the only socialist team in football. They're owned by the fans, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Aaron Rodgers. I didn't know him from Adam. I didn't know anything about him, but he goes on to Jeopardy and because he wants the job and he was like laid back and kind of cool and funny and I liked him and hey, he's with the Green Bay Packers. What could go wrong? And now I realize not only did he lie to the public saying, I'm immunized does not mean you got the fucking vaccine, but think about it. When he went and did Jeopardy, he lied to them too. He endangered all those people in that studio when he went and taped those shows.
Right. And then every time he went into a huddle.
Every time. His
Jeopardy performance there was a jeopardizing performance when he went into the huddle. Okay?
That's right.
And then... you may not have heard the name. He defended himself on one of these shows, the Pat McAfee show.
Yes.
I think that's his name. Big sports pod, you know, YouTube, like you, big sports.
Right. Yes, like me.
Anyhow, and he had the audacity. I think even Pat McAfee was shocked when he heard him say it. He said, oh, the woke mob is coming after me.
Right.
And then he had the audacity, either that time or the very next time, to quote Martin Luther King as if he's being persecuted.
Oh, my
God. Yeah, no, I mean, I can tell you, people, look, there are going to be people who are still going to applaud him. They're going to celebrate him. I know that, okay? But I will tell you that it created a huge stir. And I don't know if I sent you this. Yesterday, I got this note. It said, from a South Asian, a Delhi, India sports website.
Okay.
Covering all the sports from, you know, cricket to soccer kind of stuff.
Right.
And headline, okay. Oh, God, I just forgot that line. But it was like, Twitter explodes as Harvey J.K. lambastes Aaron Rodgers. I'll try to send it to you. I saw your tweet.
I'm like, I'm a part owner. And that's why I knew I had to ask you about it. This is a guy who had a really good reputation. People
this
liked
guy
him,
had a
and he tanked it in a split second.
Yeah. No, this is, look, he didn't graduate, but he did go and play football at Berkeley. It's not exactly a lightweight school.
No.
Okay. It's just shameful. I can't decide which word works better. Is it shameful or is it shameless?
Well, it's shameful. Shameful. He feels no shame, I guess. And I'll tell you what's disappointing. His fiance is the actress Shailene Woodley or something.
Woodley, yeah.
And she's like a big liberal. She is an activist. He said on that show, I'm an athlete, not an activist. Well, she's an activist. And she screwed herself also by defending him by talking about his dick size.
What?
Yeah, it was a thing about the size of his hands and feet and making innuendo
that he's got big
feet and big hands. You know what that means.
Well, some of the people I know in the media said to me, I thought he was a progressive.
Yeah, I did too. Guess
so not. I think we all thought that, you know, I really all thought that.
Yeah,
so.
What a shame. And then he's like, I checked with my friend Joe Rogan. Oh, my God. And I took ivermectin. Okay. Boom. There's the last nail in the coffin. Go away.
A Canadian friend of mine said, what kind of doctor does he see? And by the way, you know, there is a place for homeopathic medicine.
Sure.
But that's, I think he went to a veterinarian. I don't know what else to say.
Oh my God, Harvey J.K. I don't know what the answer is. I'm so over
Let's think good thoughts. You're going to see Jackson Brown and
James Taylor. I'm going to go enjoy good music tonight.
Oh my God.
So I'm putting this out of my head. I've got 20 seconds left. Harvey J.K., as always, thank you. Let's get you and
always
John Nichols together. And
Be great.
We'll
Be
talk.
Great. Thank you. Enjoy yourself.
Thank you. And then to everyone listening, thank you. And I'll see you tomorrow. We'll be back with Howie Klein tomorrow. Until then, be good. Don't shoot anyone. And take your vaccine. All right. See you tomorrow, everyone. Bye.